All right, it's probably time to get underway. Welcome back to the afternoon session, everyone. Next up, we have Charles Gray, research engineer, occasional PhD student, really good hacker, and he's going to be talking about Darwin on top of L4. So over to you, Chuck.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Welcome to my talk, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm talking about Darwin virtualizing a Unix kernel on the L4 microkernel. So, quick outline of what I'll be talking about, some background details about all the different bits and pieces, project overview, talking about OS X and Darwin, that's BSD on the Mark microkernel, if you're not familiar with that. What we did support it, where we've gone, the results so far, and project status as of now. A little bit on naming, just to avoid the obvious question at the end. What the hell is Darbat? Well, we've got an L4 Linux port. We call that Wombat, after the animal. So obviously, an L4 Darwin port is going to be called Darbat. Makes sense to me. So that's why. And the other obvious question, why aren't we doing it with Linux? Well, we are. But there's no talk about the Darwin version. So traditional OS. This is what your average operating system looks like, or modern operating system, Windows, Linux, Mac OS X. You've got a bunch of applications linked against a system library, libc. They run up in user mode on the processor, and then you have an operating system all running in kernel mode on the hardware, which all has access to it. So if you're not too familiar with the CPU architecture, kernel mode basically means a bit on the CPU. When that bit's active, the processor can do whatever it likes. When you go back to user land by turning off that bit, you're restricted in what you can do if you try to access certain bits of the CPU or memory. You'll fall back into the kernel, and it can look whether that was a valid operation or not. So when you're up in user land, you're protected from doing certain things. When you're down in kernel land, you can do whatever you like on the system. There's no way to stop it. So just reiterating what Andy Tannenbaum was talking about this morning, lines of code, just a quick study of Linux, taken from Wikipedia. 1991 through 2006, number of lines of code, currently topping 7 million lines of code for the whole kernel, and it's increasing with a pretty good rate. And as Andy said this morning as well, if you're looking at the Windows kernel, you multiply that by a factor of 10 or something. That's an awful lot of code, and it gets running down in here somewhere. So all that code's running when the CPU can do whatever the hell it likes to your computer. So just to move on, what does that code actually do? What are some things that the operating systems do in kernel mode? Well, if you like Darwin, you have an XML parser in your kernel. If you like Linux, you can have decompression algorithms in your kernel. You can have a full-blown linker for linking bits of software together in your kernel for loading modules. You can do things like network routing, which get tremendously complex in the kernel. These things all share one thing in common. Can anyone tell me what that is? They don't belong there. They don't belong there because they don't need to be in kernel mode, okay? You're in kernel mode to do things like manipulate virtual memory, access certain device drivers, you know, various other sensitive operations. None of this needs that. And all of these things can be incredibly buggy and hard to debug, and lots of us had to do that, and that sucks. Also, device drivers. They're a fun one, as we heard this morning. They're a massive amount of code. Of the 7 million, I think Andy said it's probably about 70%. And they're 5 times more likely to have bugs in them, and they all run in kernel mode in the traditional OS. So the holy grail we've all heard about is the microkernel approach, okay? So you've got your hardware, your small microkernel, hypervisor, VMM, whatever you want to call it, in the kernel mode. A bunch of different things that do OS-type stuff running up in user land. So some very primitive operations, like mapping memory. You can request an operation to do that. The hypervisor will deliver you interrupts when they occur. And then applications run somewhere up there requesting things from user land via message passing, whatever mechanism. That's a general approach. So the idea being, get all that code out of the kernel. And you know, today basically I'm discussing an approach to doing that, which we think is cool. So virtualization, hot topic, and it's very closely related to exactly what we're doing here. Quote there, the idea is to abstract the interface between the OS and the hardware. Pioneered by IBM CP67 back in 1967. And one thing you can do is break the one-to-one OS-to-machine mapping, because the OS no longer expects to be manipulating the actual CPU itself. It's got an abstract interface, you can virtualize that, create multiple OSs, etc. Cool thing I realized today, 1967, happy 40th birthday virtualization. It's been around for 40 years, how cool is that? And because it's been around so long, If you look at the design space of virtualization, it's big, and this is just, you know, touching the surface of the household names we know about today. I've actually neglected to put KVM on here, sorry. But you've got, along the bottom axis, I'll put the transparency of virtualization. So something like VMware Server, which is very transparent, runs a binary OS up in, you know, virtualized, that is very transparent to the OS. Down here, we have things like Xen, Wombat, and Darbat, which I'm talking about today. On the vertical axis, we've got how much code do you actually trust when you're executing things? How much code is below that kernel line? Things like, if you've ever heard of Nooks, UML, or Linux on Linux, that is a lot of code you've got to trust in the kernel still to do those. Things like Darbat, we're taking out as much as possible. Wombat's then a bit higher. There's other techniques, pre-virtualization, other things up there. That's just a, you know, a bit of a map of what's happening, and I'm talking about down here. Another interesting topic, to talk about HyperKit. So Intel's modern CPUs have VT extensions. The idea being you can actually virtualize with the hardware rather than having to do tricky software tricks like VMware does. This is all well and good until you get to the idea of a HyperKit. So most modern operating systems, Linux, Windows, OS X, you name it, you can download a third-party module into your kernel and run some kernel code. That runs with full privileges. It can turn on VT mode. So basically the idea is you download a third-party module, which is malicious, some kind of Trojan, or you infect it through some exploit in kernel mode, and then lift your currently running OS into a virtual machine. Probably not that hard to do. Once you've got that, the OS is running in a virtual machine and has no idea what's going on. It thinks it's still on native hardware. You can emulate everything transparently, except for maybe some really subtle timing things. And then profit, you can do what you like. Any piece of data that goes across the system that goes through the kernel, which is pretty much anything, you can inspect, copy, send out over the network, whatever. So these things are hard to find, hard to detect, hard to delete. You can have one and have no idea it's there. So getting things out of kernel mode is a good thing. So that's about, you know, background of virtualization or whatever. What about Darbat? So we're paravirtualizing the Darwin kernel. Darwin kernel is the core of Mac OS X. It's public, it's out there, it's open source, you can download it. And paravirtualized meaning we're actually hacking on the kernel itself. So before I had the horizontal axis, it's on this side because we're modifying things that's not transparent to the kernel itself. We're using L4 microkernel as a hypervisor. I'll discuss some of its features. It's different from things like Linux, but shares a lot of very similar ideas. We're isolating the kernel and device drivers. So that's one of the key things we do with Darbat, which no one else is really doing. We're splitting the OS in two, maybe even more later, and going, okay, over one side we've got the core kernel functionality and the device drivers elsewhere, because they're five times more buggy, they're more likely to crash. And I'll go through that later. And also, we get the standard virtualization benefits. We can run multiple instances of Darwin at one time on the one machine. Why on earth do we want to do this? Virtualization, flexibility, robustness, taking code out of the kernel, all lots of good reasons. I won't go through them all. So what does Mac OS X look like? Where does Darwin fit into the big picture? What on earth is it? So here we have our hardware. The kernel itself is actually called XNU. I believe it's a funny joke. 10 is not Unix. Like GNU, GNU is not Unix, whatever. In XNU, you have some open drivers, which can be compiled into the kernel. Up in userland, you've got Launchd, they're replacing for init, and you've got a bunch of Unix applications, FreeBSD, 5 userland. That's Darwin. If you go and buy an Apple and all that stuff, they give you some binary drivers as well, and you also get the shiny GUI and a bunch of extra applications that run on top of that GUI and a bunch more stuff. So we're just looking at the left-hand side of the thing for the most part, but the other comes into it later. So that's Darwin, and XNU is the kernel part. So if we break apart Darwin and have a look inside, we have what I would call a rather unique kernel design. Unique as in weird. So as I said, you've got applications running on top, Unix or OS X, whatever, at the kernel level, you don't care. You've got the Mark III microkernel, which I'll discuss in a short while. A derivative of 4.4 BSD, which is compiled and linked against the Mark III microkernel. And device drivers, they're not taken from BSD, they're a completely new device driver kit called IOKit, or new for OS X, I believe. Like I said, full BSD 5 user environment. You can run all the BSD apps. It's a very native BSD system. It's quite handy to have. So the Mark kernel, it was once a hot research topic. There were many attempts at doing BSD and other things on top of Mark. It gave microkernels a really bad name because the performance sucked and it was hard to deal with and various other reasons I won't go into. And as you'll note, though, Darwin is a monolithic Mark kernel. They've gone and co-located all the other interesting stuff in there, so you don't get any advantages of the microkernel, so to speak. But you know, a nice flowery picture of what you might want to do is have hardware with Mark and file system modules a la Dominic's talk this morning over there. But that's not what's actually done. So looking even closer, how does BSD fit into this kernel environment? Okay, like I said, for user land, BSD, fork, mmap, listen, all those standard calls get reflected straight down into a BSD via a systole table in the kernel. So you make a BSD trap, it's a native system call. Once you're in the kernel though, BSD is basically there, if you look around the kernel code. You've got things like BSD TCP stack, HFS file system, UFS file systems, various other BSD services, lots of cool kernel services. However, that's about all there really is to it. Most of the guts of the machine management are done down in Mark. So your scheduler and your VM are done down there. Then you've got things like thread processors, and UBC is the page cache. It's where you cache all your data from disk, etc. Those are kind of split between the two. So there's like a Mark and a BSD thread structure and process structure and bits and pieces. So these two are quite intertwined. But you know, BSD's there, and it's really cool. It gives you a BSD environment. Over the other side, we have IOKit, which I'll talk further about in a second, and that's where your device drivers go. It's pretty cool. And interrupts pretty much get delivered straight from Mark through to IOKit, all compiled together as one bundle. There's a lot of rumors out there that, like, BSD runs as a user process, and a lot of the Apple documentation you read seems to imply that it's this little module off somewhere that isn't really interacted with the rest of the system. It's a load of junk compiled into the thing. So the IOKit, how many people here have written device drivers or played around with device drivers? Yeah, a handful. I don't know about you, but I find most device driver systems a pain in the ass. IOKit is actually really, really, really cool. If you're ever hacking around into device drivers, have a look at IOKit. It actually makes C++ useful. I never thought it was possible, but I've got to admit IOKit does it. So they end up with a very cool driver stack. So you end up with a PCI bus, has a bunch of nubs on it. And nubs attach devices, and devices have nubs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you start bus scanning at the bottom, and you build up this really cool hierarchical object-oriented structure of what the whole system looks like. And you can inspect that from user land with some commands. So you've got ATA. ATA has disks on the bus, and disks have partitions, and it goes on and on and on, and there's more and more on top. And you can either use that, for example, paging, talk directly to disk, which is pretty cool. File systems, talk down through partitions. And you can even, if you're, for example, the UI, I believe, talk directly to a user client, which is like a module you load on top in the driver stack. And you can actually communicate directly to drivers without having to use iStore and other things. You get a really nice, rich interface to interact there. So IOKit's a really cool system. Unfortunately, you have to use Mark message for that, but we'll talk about that later. So how do you make BSD, which is I don't know how old, talk to IOKit, which is not so old? And this is all C++, and that's all C code. So if you look inside your Unix kernel, you've got something called the BDEV switch, which is basically a table of all your block devices. They do some very cool things inside Darwin, where C++ basically registers a little C compatibility layer in there and registers callbacks. So while you've got this nice structure here, you still register your device driver in the table as though it was a straight C device driver, do all the translations later, and you end up with, you know, the BSD code is unchanged from I don't know how long, and you can still use all your old BSD RAM devices and things like that, loopback devices, other things. And of course, you can index that either by going through reads through a file system or straight an iStore to a device. So that's basically, you know, the kernel of Darwin in a nutshell. What about L4? Well, we think it's better than Mark. We think it's much better than Mark. It's a second generation microkernel, so we want to learn the mistakes of Mark and other systems. Pay attention to things like cache, TLB, and complexity. I haven't mentioned this yet, but basically one of the things that slows Mark down is that anytime you call into the kernel for some service, it puts the whole cache, you come back out, and you've got to refill the cache from memory, so every memory access is very expensive. L4 is particularly pedantic about making sure that doesn't happen, so as tiny as possible. The goal is make microkernels work. We think we're doing that. And because of all this, 10 to 20 times performance improvement over Mark, which is about the same as the size reduction. 10,000 lines versus 100 to 200,000 lines of code. So what does L4 look like? One thing I like to think about it is it's a CPU driver, okay? It's not an operating system. it's just a driver for the CPU. So like you've got a device driver, which you request certain services from some disk or something, you request services from the CPU, and that's what you get. So down here you've got hardware, then you've got a blown up version of what is in L4, quite simply. You've got a few threads, you've got address spaces, and you've got a scheduler, and that's it. No drivers, no nothing, no file systems, no XML parsers, nothing that doesn't need to be there. At least pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be there. So things like interrupts, how does all this work? They can get delivered straight up into your OS kernel with very little overhead. This can be made at, you know, incredibly short paths through the kernel with very little cost. Page faults and exceptions, user processes love to do those sorts of things. They run into L4 and then get eventually reflected up to the OS kernel or whatever as necessary. When it's not doing anything else, you round robin a bunch of threads. Threads, of course, are incredibly lightweight in L4. They're not like a typical thread. What you end up with is basically CPU context. And L4 tries to make it so that any operation you're doing is bound by hardware costs, not by L4 costs. So if you go to Linux or to Mac or most systems and you request to send a message to someone else, you pay a lot of cost, which is all the software costs, and then a bit of cost, which is the actual hardware switching from one process to another. In L4, it's the other way around. Most of the time is the hardware doing switching, and a tiny bit of time is actually the software to drive that. So now that we know what L4 is, we want to work out what DAVAD is. We want to decompose this Darwin kernel to tackle this complexity problem. Too many lines of code in the kernel. Let's split it all apart, make it a much better system. We want to add flexibility while we're there, because there's some pretty cool things you can do while you're at it. And we want to be able to maintain or improve performance, okay? We don't want any of this, you know, slow down 10% too much. We want to be as close as we can to native performance, if not even faster than native. And all while maintaining binary compatibility. That doesn't only mean Darwin, that means Mac OS X where we can. So, how the hell do we do that? DAVAD model. Okay, so we've got hardware in L4 at the bottom. That's what we're building in the kernel. We want to have, you know, multiple Mac instances and BSD instances there. Okay, so we can have multiple operating system instances. While we're at it, we might as well have multiple IO kits on the other side so we can split apart device drivers for fault tolerance. Currently, we have to have a few bit of subcodes. Bits of subcodes, some driver sub over here, and some BSD sub over there. We're going to get rid of that later, just implementation detail. And then your applications run as user processes talking to these kernels, but don't really know that there's anything different. And we can split the system up so timers get delivered to your local kernel, and interrupts get delivered to the appropriate device driver over there. And hopefully the system will all work nicely. So what can you do with a system such as this? First, an obvious one, server consolidation. That's what everyone loves virtualization for, really. So we want to run multiple XNU kernels on a system. The interesting thing about DAVAD, which separates it from VMware, Xen, the others, you can do that with multiple kernels, but one IO kit, because you don't really need to virtualize devices as much as most systems do. You've still only got one network card, you've only got, you know, one disk, you've only got one display. You don't need to have a full-blown display driver, network card, NVIDIA, and whatever in each of the kernels. So you put your device drivers out into separate modules, and the kernels just have tiny little subs which know how to talk to those things. So it's a much cleaner approach without all this replication and emulation. And that's why we say we have a simpler device driver model. One of the interesting things we've been doing just recently is multiplexing block and console devices. So this is a bit of a crazy diagram, I'm sorry, but it's a bit of a crazy thing we're doing. So you've got your multiple XNU things with applications running on top. And you might have multiple disks down here. So you need to work out, okay, who gets these disks? So you've got the V block, the virtual block device. So each of your kernels registers with the virtual block device, and he decides which disk which kernel gets. So you boot up, you always make sure each person gets the right disk. You don't want to give them the wrong disk, and they go, I didn't get that format, or, oh, look, this is, you know, you get the wrong disk, it's all bad. So you need to be able to do that. The other one is the vconsole. So you've only got one keyboard, one mouse, one screen. So you've got your keyboard, video, and mouse drivers in IOKit, but you've got multiple kernels. So this guy just sits on the keyboard, monitors keystrokes, you can control backslash between OS instances and just multiplex the whole thing. So it's like a software KVM, much cheaper and easier. So that dotted line is like, yeah, you multiplex, you switch between those two. The interesting and crazy thing that we've done recently is this blue line here. You might decide that this is your real kernel that's running the whole system, and over here you've got a test kernel or something else. You don't want to give him a real disk, So you can actually loop the VirtualBox device back into an application in another Darvad instance and get him to provide the disk data. So you end up with some really cool virtualization there. You can write that in Python, Perl, Ruby, whatever you like. It can pull stuff off a website. It doesn't matter. The other guy thinks he's getting a full-blown actual physical disk device. Pretty cool stuff. Next one is crashable drivers, okay? So device drivers are buggy, we know this, and drivers crash, and they do it in the worst way. They'll crash while they hold the lock, and you end up with locking problems, and your whole system will freeze immediately or eventually. They'll do it hogging resources. They'll allocate a whole bunch of memory, so network packets, you name it. Then they'll fall over, and you don't know whether you can reclaim those. You may not be able to, you may not have accounted for it, you may not know if there's DMA buffers pointing to it and you're going to trash it. So let's isolate these drivers and keep performance. One way you can do that, which is the way we're looking at it, isn't to break the system down into as many pieces as you can. You certainly can do that with L4, but that's not the Darvad approach. Instead, what you can do is you can realize that when you've got something like a disk stack and a network stack, it's very rare that these two would actually communicate back and forth. Okay, if you're writing an NFS server, that may be the case, but typically a disk request comes in, goes down to a disk stack, hits the disk drive. Network comes in, goes down to the network stack, goes to the network drive, and it's completely separate in each of those cases. So what you can do is you can actually put the disk from the bottom level to the top of to the disk stack there, and then your kernel over there. And your network stack in a separate one, and USB stack in a separate one, and to separate the system into columns rather than a myriad of little pieces. And that gives you much fewer context switch overheads, much faster system in general, and much less having to hack around the existing code. It's much more compatible. Of course, some devices are still critical, and you know, if the disk that is your root partition falls over, even if you can't restart it, something else, you know, you're not happy. But hey, for the most part, I don't care if my little clicky device driver crashes. I don't want it taking down my kernel. Another interesting thing that L4 can do, which other virtualization systems don't do, is VMware scheduling. Okay? So most virtualization systems, Zen, VMware, whatever, will give each of these guys 1/3 of the CPU, or whatever you predefine, and give them each an appropriate time slot. And maybe they'll decide if one of these guys executes the halt instruction to stop scheduling them for every now and again. But you don't actually know what the priorities are inside these operating systems. Over here, I might have SETI at home or something. And over here, I decide I want to run an ultra important compile or whatever, or some task which is incredibly important to me to get done. There's no way necessarily, in typical systems, you'll end up sharing the CPU 50-50, 1/3, 1/3, 1/3 with L4, because L4 knows about the threads inside itself rather than just machines. L4 can go, okay, that application's the highest priority. I'll give him the most time. Then I'm going to switch over to him. Back here, back here, back here, and get a much better, much saner approach to scheduling on the CPU across the whole system rather than time slicing individual OSs. Of course, you can still time slice individual OSs if you want, but it's something you can do with L4. You can't do with other systems as easily. Reliable servers is another interesting thing. Oh, sorry, question.
Can Wombat do that as well?
I don't know as much about Wombat, but currently I don't think so. It probably could. Sorry?
Not at the moment.
Yeah. 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 But this is just currently, done. Reliable servers. This is something you can do with any virtualization system as before, but it's a lot more lightweight in L4 because you've got more of a process model than a machine model. So over here I've got my typical OS, whatever that is, structured however it is. But then I've got things like I might want a software watchdog. So if I decide my OS has crashed, I might want to reboot the machine or send an email or whatever. If I put that inside my OS and my OS has crashed, my machine's not going to reboot itself. You need an expensive off-chip watchdog. But if I've got a microkernel here, which is incredibly resilient, I can write a very simple watchdog in a few lines of code that just checks the liveliness of this guy and takes appropriate action. And because if this guy crashes, then he'll still be scheduled, so it's no problem. You can do it all in software. We do that all the time for debugging. It's really, really handy. And you can put things like debuggers in there. And if you've got some super secret data, you can put it in a key manager and an external thing if you're really paranoid and don't want third-party apps stealing it. You also notice I put the big nasty word there, DRM. I don't know if any of you read the rant by, I think it was a New Zealand guy, about Vista and the DRM, the lengths they're going to inside Vista to try and prevent people from loading third-party modules. And just, it's obscene what this guy says they do. I don't know if they do it, but if half of what he says is true. So in Vista, you'll be running nicely on your super high resolution display with your excellent graphics card, watching a video. You load a third-party module. Microsoft decides that's not signed appropriately, and the graphics card will then blur all your output to make sure you're not trying to steal, you know, someone's IP. If you ask me, that's kind of wrong. I don't know if you agree with me. The L4 approach, though, if you're using a system like this, stick that crap in a separate address space. It doesn't belong in the kernel with everything else. If it's actually a security thing, put it in a secure place, mess around with your DRM over there, you won't lose your performance, you won't have any problems. You can still load all your other modules in here. There's no actual thing. Enforce the security with real security. Don't mess around the bush. I mean, we know that DRM is not going to work anyway. I was just reading that, you know, there's an HD DVD ISO up on BitTorrent now. You can all go grab that. So, you know, don't do it the Microsoft way. Go the real secure way. Signing doesn't work. Also, as someone mentioned a second ago, Wombat, of course, heterogeneous systems. L4 is OS agnostic. It wasn't written for one particular OS or any particular part. So we've got Linux. We've got a form of BSD at the moment. You can put whatever you like there. We've got other OSs. They can share devices. They can share file systems, various things like that. So before we had the XNU component running on top, Jeff over here, where is he? Oh, he's over there. Jeff had the IO kit working, running device drivers. The device drivers are pretty useless by themselves without someone to actually access devices. So he just grabbed Wombat, plugged it into IO kit, and was using Darwin device drivers with the Linux kernel, and then doing some benchmarking and various other cool things like that. Since then, we've pulled up XNU, but we don't currently support Wombat in the same image, so we haven't tested it recently. But there's no good reason this shouldn't work, and all our new infrastructure should make it work even better. So that's a pretty cool trick you can do. Results so far. Drivers, so far, the results have been conclusive, and we've got some more stuff. We had some pretty silly interfaces before, and that's being fixed. We've got some interesting results with system calls, pthreads, and kernel service requests. Syscall performance. All right, macOS 10.4.7, if we have a simple Unix app just making null system calls to the XNU kernel, about 2,500 cycles. The DAVAT 0.2 release, you can get off our webpage, Unix app, talking to XNU, which logically is, of course, the black line. Practically, you've got to go through L4 back to XNU. 2,400 cycles, we're cheaper. We put in an optimization to copy things in registers and actually made it faster to use DAVAT than it is on macOS 10. Of course, you could put the same fix into macOS 10 if you could modify macOS 10, but you can't. But it just shows that our overheads are not more than you can actually get by just tuning the system you've got already. MIG optimization. So any microkernel-like thing has a component system on it, basically, and Mark 1 is MIG. So macOS 10.4.7, if you want to request task info, so find out a little bit of information about my currently running process, who am I? That's a MIG call. So what you have to do is you have to run through a stub on the client in the application, go through the syscall dispatch in the kernel, go through a MIG server to decode this request and work out what it is and unmarshal it, execute the task info function to get the data, marshal it all back up again, go back to the syscall dispatch, go back to the stubs, get the data out at the other end. Okay? It's an awful lot of work. It's about 6,000 cycles there. And interestingly, though, there's a bunch of features in here you never use and a bunch of wasted time. Our version is 4,000 cycles. So we've once again cut off about 33% there. We've done so by removing redundant stuff. All the MIG stuff adds a whole bunch of overhead that no one uses. The whole idea is you can, like, redirect task info to another process to virtualize the process and whatever. No one ever uses it. You don't need it. It's a waste of time, so we can actually trim the system down. L4 gives you enough security details that you can pull this stuff out without making it a security problem. So while we're not functionally identical, we are security-wise. We haven't lost anything for actual security. And we're a whole bunch faster, which is good, because MIG sucks. In-task synchronization. This is another interesting one. So we've got a whole bunch of threads in a single Unix application. They're competing for some resource. So they use the pthread lock, or a pthread semaphore, I think, is the actual thing we're using. Using that once you hit contention, you're talking 17,000 cycles on every call to try and request to get access to this resource. With DAVAT, instead of going through XNU, you can implement the same thing with the same features using L4 in 6,500 cycles, less than half. So that's, you know, a massive speed improvement because L4's primitives are much more lightweight and you don't always need the heavyweight market primitives. because they've got a really dumb algorithm is the reason why it's so slow. Yeah, it is, because we've got the semantics they want are really bad. And I don't think we actually bothered optimizing it. We just, you know, had a laugh and went, yeah, that's pretty good. And went making it faster. And, of course, to do IPC optimization. So one thing microkernels love doing is IPCing stuff everywhere. L4IPC is a subset of Mark IPC. We actually tried ripping Mark off out of the system and just doing the BSD bit by itself. Turns out applications and whatever actually use the Mark stuff, which is unfortunate. But L4 is like, you know, one tiny bit there. And most messages or a lot of messages are quite simple. So we could runtime perform optimizations on some messages. So if someone's handing a short message from one person to another person, that can be done in L4 without having to go through all the Mark overhead, similar to the synchronization problem, we can just do a bypass in L4, hopefully. We've got to look into this exactly, but you know, it'll cut down 100,000 cycles to a few hundred cycles or something like that. Next interesting thing, we've actually started doing some of this, as I've shown you, this slide's an old one. One thing which I think is fun is kernel scripting, okay? Sometimes you just want a hack. You just want to do something quickly and dirty, okay? So I want another virtual network card to check that my packet filter is working before I put it on the real network card. So I just want to, you know, make a Python script which takes packets and logs them so I can look at the right packets and not the wrong packets. Or, you know, there's a million different reasons. People have stuck various interpreters inside Linux kernel, Perl, and people have done Corba and various other things so you can get access to this. But messing around inside your kernel is quite nasty. There's a lot of, you know, really brittle things in there like locks and scheduling and whatever. Very easy to break the whole system. And, you know, putting an interpreter inside your kernel can compromise the whole system. However, with Darbout, we've done all the hard work for you. We've pulled it apart, we've put the scheduler down here, and we've made it so you've got these nice, easy boundaries at the edge. So why not just put a Python process in there and then script whatever you like in Python. You can do your hack, you can run the system. You don't need to be an expert kernel programmer and you're not going to take the system down doing so. It just lets you be a lot more flexible in how things work. And you can put anything into network filters, who knows what. On to another interesting thing I thought I'd discuss. Jetpack. So Jeff's been doing a lot of IOKit stuff. This is one thing we came across while we were implementing it. Here's a timeline of Apple switching to Intel. So it wasn't until just after Apple announced said switch to Intel, and everyone jumped up and down and went, yay, and we went, hey, that'd be a pretty cool project to hack on. Let's start on this cool Darbat thing, using the Intel machines, and they had some pre-release machines that they shipped to us, or that you can get from them. So we were hacking on blah, 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 blah. Eventually they shipped Intel hardware, which in doing so broke binary compatibility. That wasn't very fun, so all the work we'd done until here was now incompatible, and until they actually released the source code, mid last year, we were stuck without being able to do any compatibility tests and whatnot. They went out of their way, apparently, to break binary compatibility, which wasn't fun for us. So what do you do? Well, let's take a quick lesson in C++ and how it works. This is my typical C++ class. It declares a bunch of data types and a bunch of virtual functions. The compiler translates that into an offset table, which represents that class. So when you construct an instance of a class, you get a piece of memory that looks something like that layout. And then how do you use that? When I call a function, I end up pushing on my arguments and just dereferencing into the class variable and jumping to some location in memory. So if someone wanted to be nasty, they could rearrange. I'll just look back. You can rearrange the order of these things in your header file. It'll rearrange the output here, and if you try to run the same code with the new binary, you jump to who knows what, complete junk. And you can just, inserting a single value somewhere will just completely break binary compatibility. So after a whole bunch of pain and whatever, Jeff went and manually inspected all the new headers, compared them to the old headers, patched the old headers, rearranged things, and got it so that what we were compiling was actually binary compatible with the new system, which meant we could run all the new binaries during this world of pain time, which is a pretty cool hack. I was very impressed with that one. So, what have we learned so far? Darwin's pretty modular. I'm actually impressed with how easy it is to split out IOKit from the rest of the kernel. Splitting up BSD and mask, not so easy, but it can probably be done. What we found you can't do is get rid of mask altogether. That's not going to happen, unfortunately. But it's quite modular, and this has been pretty straightforward to do. Binary compatibility. No matter what your philosophical reasons are, you know there's arguments both sides as far as I'm concerned, but binary compatibility works, even at the device driver level. We're running binary chips from Apple and third parties on something we've compiled, even doing it when they tried to deliberately break compatibility because people were pirating the OS. So, you know, device driver binary compatibility is excellent as far as I'm concerned. Mac OS X has bugs, believe it or not. You know, it kind of goes without saying, but when you're sitting there for a week and a half hacking on some bug because you've gone and broken file system remapping and you're hacking away and you can't find what the bug is, then you scratch your head and then you boot up an OS X machine and try the same operation and it locks hard, it's not your fault. We've done this a few times. We've found it on the disk and on the network and various other things. You know, you're trying to ping some machine, it's telling you it's out of memory trying to ping and you've just booted it and it's got a few hundred meg. Turns out macOS has a bug related to that too, if you don't quite initialize the network card properly. So it's usually better to start sooner with checking that it's not compatible with the previous system. Performance? We're getting pretty damn good performance, I think you'll agree. We can even exceed native with a bit of work. NL4 is very, very fast, so it's not hard to get much the same. There's a caveat on that I think I should warn you about. I've only shown you the numbers I want to show you. There's a lot of things we haven't tuned, and we're not even going to measure them because we know that they'll suck. I think when we, you know, the very first thing we had that could boot and run a user process was about 1,000 times slower than native because of, you know, various hacks that you just did because, you know, you just do a long, long loop rather than doing something properly. So, no, we can work on this. Anything we've tuned, we've found you can get really good performance out of. We haven't hit any barriers yet, which is good. Debuggability is also really, really, really cool. Anyone who's tried to debug a kernel has known it's a real pain in the butt, right? You end up doing two-machine debugging or various other things or whatever. What you can do is you've got your OS is actually two modules on top of a microkernel. If your device drivers are crashing, you put some debug code in your kernel to inspect what's happening over in the other side of things, and vice versa. So when your kernel's crashing, you can put some stuff in your device drivers to debug the other side. Because the L4 microkernel very rarely crashes. Any proper microkernel shouldn't. So it actually makes it much easier to debug things when the system's actually practically still alive. And it means you can also work from home. You can put little watchdogs in there and say, you know, if everything else goes to hell, just reboot. So you don't need to be in there to physically reset the machine. And you can just go home, sit on the couch, do some work from there. Great. So what else should we do? Future work. We'd like to pull more bits out, more further decomposition. Improve the binding for an X and UNI kit. They're getting better, but there's still a lot of work to do and a lot of device drivers we don't support. We'd love a usable system. We'd like to experiment with, you know, more features I've been talking about, system-wide benchmarks, and the other one I forgot to add here is port to the latest code base because Apple have released newer code. So in summary, Unix kernels are feature-packed. One thing I forgot to mention at the beginning, you know, they're full of lines of code. This isn't bloatware. I disagreed with Andy's what Andy was saying this morning. They're big because people want this stuff, okay? Modern network stacks are huge because modern networks are complicated. You know, you can't write these things and attempt to size, no matter how hard you try. So, you know, it's got to be there somewhere, but it doesn't need to be in the kernel. Virtualization is a way to address the code bloat. Lots of people are doing it. We're doing it slightly differently and trying to get, you know, split things apart and do it much better, we think anyway. So, any questions? And also before I allow you, there's an open day tomorrow. We've got a stand if you want to come down and have a chat about it or anything else they're doing. That's really cool.
Questions, anyone? Got a mic here.
The benchmark you had up with the in-process synchronization?
Yeah.
Does that involve changing and recompiling the Unix app, or is that
binary compatible? Darwin has, instead of having an API for the kernel, has a library interface. So we can, and they've got libsystem, which is libc plus a bunch more. We can hack that to pieces and still be completely compatible with the rest of the system. So yeah, that's just hacks to the libsystem. And you just, well, the dynamic link picks up most of it.
I've got a couple more. Do you see, I know you said you don't know too much about Wombat, but I think there's some other people in the room that do. Which do you see as being better for performance in the future, based on the architecture of Linux and the architecture of Darwin? Which do you see having less overheads when running on L4?
Yeah, no matter what you do, you can have more overheads from doing more context switches, so we're just trying to minimise them. We'd like to think that, you know, it's in the noise. You're going to have much more problem with, you know, network latencies and jitter and whatever than you will with the extra costs you add. But theoretically, you can't beat the way, you know, Wombat or even Linux kernel native is structured, because it's just that much closer to being on the raw hardware.
Yeah. And what's stopping you from running the Mac OS X GUI?
Various things.
Legal reasons?
Not that we know of. they apparently encrypt the GUI binary, and we're running, like I said, on an older kernel, and I don't think we can support whatever they need. We also don't have various things like inside our XNU, we can't load device kernel extensions. We can only load them to the device driver part. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that we just can't do yet. We'll get to it eventually. If it'll work, I never know.
Everyone
join me in
thanking Chuck for that talk.
Thank you.
We've run a bit over time for the next talk, 5 minutes.